financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
The woman gets none of my social references. I talked in my Apple Watch. I said, I feel just like Dick Tracy. And she's got a blank look on her face.
Yeah, who's Dick Tracy?
Has no idea what I'm talking about. So it's been an adjustment, but I'm lucky. She's a brilliant student.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jay Dean, along with the Money Doctor, Francis Raham. What's going on?
We're going deeper than politics as usual. We have a returning guest, Senator Michael D. Brown, who spent 18 years as a U.S. shadow senator for Washington, D.C., fighting for representation. Can you believe this? And, of course, raising the roof whenever it was necessary. So he's been really outspoken on the barriers that young people face today, as well as a number of other issues. And I like him because he calls things like he sees them.
He makes good trouble.
Yeah, he makes good trouble. Exactly. So he recently shook things up a little bit by teaming up with a 21-year-old woman co-host on his podcast, Shadow Politics. And I just had the pleasure of joining them. So today we're flipping the mic back around.
Cool.
And I have to say, this is completely unscripted in case you can't tell, folks. That's how our shows always are. And we're going to talk about everything we can cram into one special edition, from food insecurity to federal dysfunction and personal triumphs to political theater. So let's dive in. So welcome back, Senator. Thank you for coming.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. You know, you're so much fun to talk to. For the same reason that you call them like you see them, and I appreciate that.
Thank you very, very much. You know, you've been in public service a long time. Wait, did I say that? Did that make you sound old?
A long time.
Okay, and you have seen power up close, right?
But I have.
You came from really humble beginnings. I think that's fair to say, right? I hope you don't mind me saying that.
No, I mean, I think what I had was an advantage as a kid. I mean, I started working when I was 14 years old, and I did come from a background where we were always broke, but I grew up in a white middle-class kind of working-class neighborhood. There were a lot of people around me that cared about me, and, you know, I had a lot of support. And when I was a kid, I loved working. I loved having my own money and, you know, and trying to help my family out, which is what I did. And, you know, back in the days, I tell my kids all the time, all these things I did. But then I think back and I say, you know, gas was 28 cents a gallon when I pumped it. And you got a free glass if you got 8 gallons of gas. Now, think about that. That's about $2 worth of gas. You got a free glass, and we washed your windows and put air in your tires and whatever else you needed. So, and so I could live on $2 a week. But I think the thing that was beneficial for me is that it built in me a really strong work ethic, you know, and I always worked hard. And I think that came in handy. And I think that the one thing that distresses me most when you want to talk about young people right now is that I see a lot of them giving up hope. That's the thing that bothers me most.
Yeah. It is about choices, for sure. I mean, we do, you know, here, that's what we do, is help people figure out what their priorities are and fund those. But for instance, you have been living in Washington, D.C. Now you're moving to an island off the coast of Maryland with Mrs. Brown, and hosting this Shadow Politics podcast with a 21-year-old woman named Liberty. So there's a few changes here, you know. You know, that might sound a little bit like I'm spotlighting your successes, but as we know, you've had hard times. So when we talk about, you know, young people feeling this way, I brought this topic up when we were talking on your podcast with Liberty, that they're not the first generation to face tough times. They won't be the last, probably. So, okay, here's a question for you. If you could turn the clock back and ask a question of your 21-year-old self, what would the question be? And what would his answer be?
I would ask my 21-year-old self what was really important in life. And I think my 21-year-old self would probably give some lame answer to that question, like some material thing or some, you know, not understanding that there are much deeper, more important things in life than what you own and what you have. And let me just tell you that, you know, because I grew up in the 1960s, so I was, you know, we were all about consumerism. I mean, we all hugged each other and wore tie-dye t-shirts and sang Kumbaya, but the truth of the matter was that when 1970 rolled around, we all copped out, got jobs, bought houses, you know, did whatever. And I think that I was much more focused on getting ahead in those days and really didn't understand what getting ahead was. You know, it's really not so much getting what you want. It's more wanting what you've got. You find that out as you get older and what's really important, my children, relationships, friends, the associations you build, the experiences you have in life. And it's hard to see that at 21. I dropped out of high school, so going to college was a big deal for me. I got in to a community college because of a equivalency diploma, and I got a degree, so the four-year college took that, and I got another degree, so I went on and got a master's degree, but that was very important. I was really consumed by it at that time because I worked as well as went to college. That's another thing. I always had an objective, and I would say that's so important when you're young, is not to be rudderless. That's another thing that I think my 21-year-old self wouldn't have known, is that you really have to follow what your passion is, right? Whatever that is. And politics was my passion.
Yeah. What do you think he would have said back to you if you'd said any of those things?
Something really stupid, like, really, man, I get it. You know, even though I didn't. Yeah. I had a brilliant sister. I had a brilliant sister who was a lawyer, and I used to drive her crazy with stuff like that. She said something to me, I go, really? I was kind of a punk. So I had a chip on my shoulder, you know. And it wasn't until, you know, I started getting in trouble and realized that, you know, badass wasn't really a profession that I was going to be good at, so that I should, you know, turn into a nice guy or, you know, it just wasn't me. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't the tough guy that I tried to be.
Well, you certainly directed your badass self into politics, right?
And I had help. I had a sister, you know, I had an older sister who saw everything for, you know, she would, I thought about going to law school one time. And she said, she looked at me and she said, you can't go to law school. You'll never make it through law school. You won't make it through the first semester because you can't buy the textbook. See, I'll never forget this. She said, you can't buy the textbook 2 weeks before the semester's over. Okay. Yeah. So I didn't go to law school, and she was right. I went into graduate school, and she was, by the way, she was very proud of me when I got my master's degree in social science and political science. Somebody asked her what my degree was in, and my sister said, I had just gotten a degree in the study of the obvious. She thought there were two types of people in the world, lawyers, which she was, and people that weren't smart enough to be lawyers and they became brain surgeons or something else.
Yeah, and she was wrong. And it turned out that you found your path.
She was wrong.
Yeah, you found your path in something great. Speaking of finding a path in something great, Jay has been doing this North Quabbin Foodathon for 22 years. He and his brothers actually started it. And they feed through six pantries. They raise enough money through six food pantries locally to feed a district, to help feed a district, right? And so it's gotten bigger and bigger every year, and he can tell you a little bit about that. But this was my first experience with it. Jay asked me to come in and help interview a few people, and I was happy to do that. But it was 12 hours of people feeding their neighbors, right? They don't know who they're feeding, but they're digging deep and they're coming out with money to feed their neighbors. I tried not to get political about this, but we did have two politicians that were interviewees while I was there, and they both gave great answers to things, but I just couldn't help but think, meanwhile, Washington's tangled up in these headlines from, Trump's trial to the big beautiful bill that, dare I say, might throw a bunch of a boatload of
Which
people
passed
into
the House by one vote. Yeah.
big beautiful
One vote.
bankruptcy.
Boy, we will be back with part two of Financial Fitness. This is so interesting with the money doctor, Francis Ram. I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number?
Of course, they can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561. How are we going to bridge that gap between something like the grassroots action that the foodathon that Jay is involved in, and I would love it if he can give a better description than I've given, and national distraction. So, Jay, I'll ask you first to give us a little
Well,
background on it.
the foodathon itself, we just started in 2004 to just try to do something every year that would make a difference. And everybody was saying it would be nice, Senator, if we didn't have to do this again. Well, of course, as you know, I'm sure that's not going to happen. So it's been going on since 2004. And thankfully, we get a guest every year in the name of Jim McGovern. And he, always comes on and proclaims, and I believe him, that this problem is fixable. We can fix it. And then at the same time told us how the House Rules Committee meeting, their hearing, was going to start at 1 o'clock in the morning anyway. So it's so ironic that we had him on, Senator, at 8:30 in the morning, and then he was back on doing his duty at 1 o'clock in the morning, holding the hearing. I mean, we wanted to do what we could do, and we asked people this year to kick in a little bit more if they could, because this effort brings in money locally and gives it right back out locally to these six pantries. There's no rigmarole in between. It goes directly to them. And, thank the Lord and the community that comes forward. As of this moment, it's $42,000 we raised in 12 hours. But it'll probably last 3 months in these pantries. And now, with these, depending upon what the Senate does with this bill, the big, beautiful bill, I don't know.
Well, you got a better chance in the Senate of having something happen. The House is just there's an old saying in politics that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And the House has certainly shown that. They're just going to
Interesting.
line up behind this guy no matter what he wants to do, no matter how absurd it is. How long do you think we could supply those pantries, Jay, if we turned in the $400 million jumbo jet that the president just received as a parting gift from his Arab friends? And first, let me say thank you for what you're doing. That's great. I know personally what a great feeling it is to feed hungry people, because for 12 years I took my children to a soup kitchen once a month during the school year. And I can't tell you, anybody that's out there that's listening, do this. It's especially if you have kids. My kids fed homeless women and realize that the one thing you could say about homeless women that you can't say about everybody else is that they're homeless. There's nice ones, there's mean ones, there's happy ones, there's sad ones. They're just like everybody else. They just need to be fed and they need to be taken care of. And it demystifies it for them. My kids have all grown up to be adults that really care about the people around them. And I really give a lot of credit for that, to the fact that there was a program that they could get into where kids fed these women at a shelter here in town.
That kind of story that I was just telling about, you know, everybody had one common goal. It was just to feed their neighbors. What do you think it would take to bring that kind of nonpartisan collaboration to Washington? And is it even possible anymore?
Well, unfortunately, history tells us that to make that happen in America, you need some kind of political crisis or disaster, right? Do you never had a greater spirit of patriotism and cooperation in America than you did during the Second World War? I mean, not for all groups of people, but in general. And we saw New Yorkers who are notoriously right. They have a reputation for being somewhat short-tempered and you know, grumpy. We saw them all come together after 9/11. Didn't matter who they were. You know, we tend to pull together when there's some need, you know, like you saw at feeding people. You know, that's the thing that brings us together. And then once we touch each other, we realize our common humanity, right? Which we all have things in common. I don't care if you voted for Donald Trump. I'm willing to bet you love your children. Just
That's
like
right.
I love my children. You know, yep. I don't care if you voted for Donald Trump. I would be willing to guess that you're glad you live in the United States. You're glad to be an American. You're glad, you know, just like I am. You know, there are a lot of things that we have in common. We have more in common than separates us. And that's why, for example, on my podcast, my first co-host, my long-term co-host, was a Republican woman from the West Coast. The idea was that we would show that this liberal guy, this liberal Democrat from the East Coast, and this conservative Republican woman from the West Coast, even though we weren't alike, we had a lot in common. And that's why I continue on the show with Liberty. I mean, I told you this when we talked, when you were on the show. It hurts for me to even say it, but Liberty is exactly 50 years younger than I am. So it's like she looks at exactly the same things I look at and see something totally different. And that's really an important thing, is right. We have to try to see from each other. We have to try to walk a mile in the other person's shoes, to quote to use an old quip. But I would tell you, if I had to leave five pieces of advice to my children, one of them would be what Einstein said, that what you see depends on where you stand juxtaposed to what you're looking at. So I think to bring us together, we all need to try to stand in the other person's position. And, you know, I've been in many of those positions. Again, I think I was benefited by the fact that I was close, that I could see poverty, that I could, I know people that were impoverished, but I myself was never impoverished. I was broke a lot of the times, but I always had everything I needed to get by. So it's easier for me, I think, to empathize with other people because I've come a long distance in my life and I've worn a lot of different hats. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to understand where people are coming from, you know? Crazy, you know, but it's been an adjustment dealing with this young. The woman gets none of my social references, you know, and it's like I have an Apple Watch and I was taught, we were at an event and I looked at my, cause she worked for me for a while. And I looked at my Apple Watch and I said, I talked in my Apple Watch. I said, I feel just like Dick Tracy. And she got a blank look on her face.
Yeah, who's Dick Tracy?
And, yeah, has no idea what I'm talking about. So it's been an adjustment, but I'm lucky. She's a brilliant student, and it's been an interesting mix. But that's what we have to do. We have to understand where these people are coming from. Like, look, a good example for me was this football player Kaepernick, who refused to stand during the national anthem. Okay. Lots of people in Washington supported his First Amendment right to express himself. Mm. And I certainly understood that. But I come from a veteran family, and I also understand why people were offended by it.
Sure.
You know, and that's what we have to do. You know, we have to try to understand where people are coming from. And we don't. There's a guy named Jürgen Habermas, a German philosopher, that says there's always a gap between theory and practice. And, you know, the theory of democracy is really, really beautiful. But the practice of it is, you know, what we say in Washington is you shouldn't watch people make policy or make sausage, you know, because the process is pretty much the same. And what starts out maybe as a very noble idea very often gets turned into something else because of the self-serving nature of our political system. You know, these people are all worried about surviving. I love people that talk about term limits. You know, they want to put term limits on people. Every congressman has a 2-year term limit. If you don't like him, don't send him back. And you may think that he's in there forever, but he never thinks that. He always worries about what's going to happen in 2 years. He always worries about the pressure. One of the first things that my colleague, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is in the House of Representatives, told me when we had our first meeting was, nothing is ever generated from inside the walls of Congress. Everything comes from outside. All the pressure comes from outside. The ideas come from outside. The policy starts from outside. And so that's the one place where we can have an effect. But unfortunately, we don't pay a whole lot of attention to politics, you know? And we have a complex system that requires intelligent input. Basically, Trump has gotten away with this because he tells us what we want to hear. There are a lot of people that are out there that want to hear, it's not your fault. The economy's doing bad, but it's not your fault. It's the fault of all these people sneaking over the border and stealing your jobs, which we all know isn't true, right? But the guy that goes to McDonald's to order something and can't understand the person on the other end of the, you know, the little mic that he orders through, because she's got a heavy accent, he said to himself, there you go. You're stealing our jobs, you know. Now, I don't know when we started worrying about the Canadians sneaking over the border and stealing our jobs, or the New Zealanders, you know. This has gotten crazy and out of hand. And what I think this guy is trying to do is just create chaos. And if he does that, he assumes that he can rebuild the government in his own image. You know, we're all getting ready for the big parade here in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
$40 million to say happy birthday, Don.
You know, I have to ask you, I mean, having had that experience at the Foodathon, I watched people from all political backgrounds working side by side with one goal in mind. How do we feed people? Nobody asked who you voted for or anything like that. I didn't hear anything that was sharply political anywhere. You almost can't avoid some stuff these days. But it was all just, how can I help? So why does that kind of unity vanish when we get to Capitol Hill?
Because, you know, everybody's following their own self-interest, and this is a problem. I mean, I would say the same thing to you with kids. If you have kids, you know that you can take 5-7-year-old kids different sexes, from different backgrounds, from different countries, and you could put them in a room and they'll bond in 5 minutes. I don't, you know, right? And older, they'll be running around playing with each other, loving each other, hugging each other. But adults can't do that, right? Because of all the stuff that gets in the way. The kids are single-minded. They want to play. That's what they want to do. You know, we want all sorts of different things. So you get up there to Capitol Hill, and everybody's following their own self-interest, and really the general welfare gets lost often in the process. And Karl Marx said this about capitalism. He says capitalism and democracy can't work because everybody following their own self-interest will never promote the general interest. In America, we've been able to change that dynamic by little things like putting a constitution in place and giving minority rights and giving, you know, and things like that. And all this stuff they're trying to get rid of right now, DEI, you know, all the other intervening things that we put to try to straighten out that process where it turns out to be survival of the fittest in a capitalist democracy. I think we're at a real turning point now. Can we translate this feeling? I think you could have the experience that you had, Doc. I think you could have in a lot of different contexts. You could have had it at a Little League game. You could have had it at some kind of event where people were coming in, a disaster relief event. When you get down to one-on-one with people, it works a whole lot better. And that's really the trick, is trying to translate that into national policy, into competing ideas and motivations.
What was that delineation between Republicans and Democrats again? Democrats want to get along?
Democrats
fall in love.
Okay. Yeah, and Republicans fall in line, and that's so true. You know, I mean, look, I've been a super delegate for many, many conventions for nominating. I've been to 13 nomination conventions for the nomination for president. I went to one where Hillary Clinton was the nominee. She had won the nomination before she went to the convention. She had a requisite number of delegates to win. And for the first 2 days of the convention, people chanted Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Bernie, 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 until Sarah Silverman actually came on stage and told them, shut up. Said, shut up, it's over. But you never see that in the Republican Party. You would never see that. I mean, you know, we shoot ourselves in the foot a lot as Democrats. You know, that's another great quote from Will Rogers. Will Rogers, and this is the most real thing I've ever found about politics. There's never been truer words spoken. He said, I belong to no organized political movement. I'm a Democrat.
This is really enjoyable talking to Senator Michael Brown. I'm sure people have questions. Can we get your phone number?
Of course. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
Or as always, go to hugyourmoney.com.
Will you help us spread the word about financial fitness? Please like, subscribe, and choose all. Thank you.